Hey everyone, welcome back to the latest episode of The Business of Cyber. When scaling product teams or building out really your security program, one of the most important pieces is the talent that you bring into the organization. My guest today is Kyle McIntyre. Kyle runs an executive search practice that's worked with firms like CrowdStrike and Netskope to build their management teams, and also companies like Cisco and United Technologies to build their in-house security programs. So I really appreciate Kyle taking the time to chat with me recently, and hope you guys enjoy my conversation with him.
Well, the party is off to a good start.
Kyle, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining me today. How are you?
Hey, Joey, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. Super excited to be here.
Yeah, of course. Well, as a way to kick us off, I'd love to maybe get a little bit of context. So do you mind telling us a little bit about yourself, your background, and sort of how you found your way into the world of cybersecurity?
Yeah, absolutely. So of course, I'm Kyle McIntyre. I run an executive search practice called McIntyre Associates. And my chief focus is on building management teams for cybersecurity vendors. So typically I'm brought in by a board member, an investor, CEO, somebody like that to build or rebuild a management team to get to an exit. So, you know, living and breathing cyber day in and day out. I also have had, you know, the good fortune to do some recruiting work on the other side of the security ecosystem, placing CISOs and chief product security officers, you know, building red teams and things like that as well. So having a blast, right? It's such an amazing industry and very grateful to be a part of it. Now, how did I find myself here? It's an interesting answer to that question. So unlike a lot of recruiters that kind of come up through staffing agencies or in-house recruiting, and then they move out, you know, to an external firm or something like that, McIntyre Associates is a family business. So my dad founded this company in the late 80s, you know, always kind of specialized in growthy industries. And ever since 2001, it's been all cybersecurity. He helped build a team at a company called Foundstone, which of course was George Kurtz and Stu McClure's first company. And so ever since 2001, he focused on cyber. Now, once I graduated my undergrad at UConn, go Huskies, I decided to join the family business. You know, I grew up around it. And while dad would read us Dr. Seuss, he'd also read us, you know, balance sheets and pitch decks and things like that. So it felt like a natural step. And so when I joined the company, he went from a, you know, a one-man show to a father and son operation. And the first company I got to work on was CrowdStrike. So spent about 5 years helping him build that whole management team, you know, through from the Series A through the IPO, you know, over a dozen C levels and VPs. And just what an amazing experience for me, right? Talk about a trial by fire. And so once I got to work on a company like that, there was no turning back. So after they IPO'd, dad retired, and I've been running the show ever since.
That's very cool. It's, you know, family business is kind of the origin. And it makes me wonder, you know, as you were sort of coming out of college and getting into the family business for the first time, and as I understand it now, you know, run the organization yourself. When you kind of think back to, you know, maybe just the experience of working closely with your dad for so long, what are some of the most important things you've learned from him?
Wow, that's a loaded question, huh?
We're getting right into it. 3 minutes in.
Yeah. No, I mean, listen, I learned obviously so much. I like to think I learned from the best. I don't know another recruiter that has done more work building management teams for cyber vendors than he has, and with great outcomes, by the way. And so, you know, learning first off, kind of what to look for when you're exploring backgrounds, right? Which is really like learning the industry, learning the history of, you know, what companies were pioneers in which subsectors of the industry, you know, which ones of them got acquired, which ones are just known by a different name now, you know, which teams were successful building these companies and which teams maybe were there but weren't successful, right? So all these kind of considerations and thinking analytically about the industry and companies and people, I think is one of the things that I learned from him that has really served me well. And I think it's important actually for anybody in the industry to think about these things. And we can kind of circle back and talk about that later on. But that would be the big one. And then of course, kind of just how he is with people. You know, I learned that you don't have to just be kind of the starchy executive recruiter. You can actually have a real person-to-person relationship with people and connect with them. And that's where I have the best recruiting calls, by the way, because that's where I am able to ask the really tough questions and get candid answers, right? If you're just kind of buttoned up and it's a transactional call, then you're not really going to get the information you're really looking for. And so that's another really key thing I learned from him, just watching him and listening to those calls over the years. And so I could go on for another hour about, and I'm sure he would love to hear that. But those were two really key things that I learned from him.
Yeah, got it. Okay. So as you've worked with CrowdStrike and, you know, some of the other very notable security vendors, just kind of an open-ended question to maybe get into some specific learnings. What are sort of the most important things that, you know, a founder or CEO should be considering when they're building their leadership team?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's, you know, there's no one size fits all answer, clearly. But I would say, to give you a really broad answer that I think is accurate, is, and this is hard to do, knowing what you need when you need it, right? There are a lot of companies that I think wait too long to build out the management team. And there are a lot of companies that I think do it way too quickly, right? Where they hire a bunch of folks that they're not quite ready for yet. So I would say, you know, being conscious of the considerations around that. Am I hiring the right roles at the right time? That's a really difficult thing for especially a first-time founder to understand. So, you know, as a follow-on to that, I would say remain open to other perspectives, right? Like seek information from people that are maybe just outside of your network, even if you don't know them. Understanding people's perspectives in the industry can really help inform, you know, your perspective and your plan. And I think that sometimes people will actually go too far that way, where it becomes like analysis paralysis and they just perseverate and keep seeking information and they end up not making a decision on time. So finding the balance there, I think, is one of the most impactful things that a founder can do, is really like realize that you don't always know everything, right? Like realize you don't know what you don't know sometimes, and surround yourself with experts and listen to those experts. Maybe you're not going to do exactly what they tell you to do, but if you talk to enough of them, you'll start to get the picture.
Yeah. Other than that, you know, maybe mistiming, or mistiming is probably the simplest way to put it. What are sort of the other like biggest mistakes that you see founders or executive teams make when they're building out a leadership team?
Sure. Yeah. And it's going to kind of extend this last answer. I mean, overhiring and underhiring, I think, is one of the most damaging things when we're talking about executives, right? C-level executives, especially. If you overhire, and I don't mean hiring too many people. I mean, like, for example, let's say you hire a chief product officer who's got a serial CPO background, right? They've been there and done this over and over again. But you're hiring them and expecting them to really get their hands dirty in the bits and bytes, you know, design the UI, stuff like that. Maybe you'll get lucky and you'll find somebody who has the business acumen who can still do that and is willing to do that. But I've seen companies make those types of hires, and then inevitably that leader ends up leaving, or something else goes off the rails because they didn't care for building a foundation for that person to utilize, right? You want to make sure that you're not wasting the talent that you're bringing in. So that would be another consideration. And then here's another obvious sounding one, is culture, right? I think that some young companies don't really have a clearly defined culture. It's still kind of nebulous. And in that scenario, I think you want to, you know, look for people who are going to be easy to work with in terms of their personality and communication style, if you, you know, so that they can help build your culture. On the flip side, if you do have a really great culture where your employees love, you know, working for you and they're loyal and they stick around, well, then you want to be very sensitive to not upset that too much. I mean, sometimes you do, as a company grows up, need to, you know, give some things up in terms of the culture. Maybe you don't have as many pinball machines in the office or whatever as you scale. But, you know, I think striking the balance there also is something that a lot of companies miss. And if you wait too long to pay attention to that kind of stuff, eventually it may not be your choice as the founder, who you get, it may be up to the board or to the investors solely, right? If you wait too long. So, you know, another very broad answer, but I think that those are really important considerations. So, you know, respect the culture or realize when you need to build a new culture. And then also, you know, don't hire somebody that you're not ready for, right? Somebody who's going to be wasted on the job.
Yeah. I'd love to talk a little bit more about the cultural aspect. You know, it's definitely something that, like, I've personally started to develop more of an appreciation for, of just the importance of, you know, as simple as like enjoying spending time with the person that you're hiring for a role or considering for a role, because
absolutely,
you can't argue the fact that, you know, we're going to spend 8 to 10 hours a day, a considerable amount of our waking hours 5 days a week with this person. So you don't have to be best friends, but you should enjoy their presence, basically.
You want to feel like they're happy to be there, right? Like,
yeah.
If I got on this call with you today and there were no smiles and no personality coming through, you'd be like, why did I do this? Right. So
right.
I think even on a first interview, you know, if you can make it a video interview, that's, you know, that's great. If somebody's just not, it doesn't seem like they're happy to be there, it's a pretty good indicator that they're probably not going to be a blast to work with either. You know, but sometimes that's not the case. Sometimes I have a tough first call with somebody because they're, you know, really asking me tough questions, and I love that. That's great. And then the personality comes out later. But I definitely think it's something you want to watch out for. You want to be around people who seem like they're happy to be there. They want to be there.
Yeah. You know, how do you encourage or recommend your, you know, the vendor companies that you work with to sort of assess cultural or personality fit? I've definitely struggled with it personally in an interview process. So, like, I'm making it kind of part of my requirements to meet somebody in person. Like, mm-hmm. I think it's just a lot easier to get a feel for someone over a drink or a lunch rather than a phone interview where you can kind of fake it.
Yeah,
totally. How do you recommend your clients approach that?
So it's interesting, right? Because it, depending on the size of the client, if it's a, because I do everything from a seed stage, you know, startup where it's just the founders, right? All the mm-hmm. way through IPO, post IPO, take private. So it depends on how many cooks you have in the kitchen. You know, if there's 7 different interviewers, making sure that before you even launch this search campaign or open the roll up, that you have your interview panel pretty clearly defined and that you guys are aligned on what you think is going to work for the role, for the company, you know, both in terms of like the candidate's experiences and outcomes, but also in terms of like how they are to be around, right? So I think getting all your interviewers aligned on the front end is really powerful, because it's all too common, I think, that you'll get a month or 2 months into a search and you start having candidates, you know, getting through the first 2, 3, 4 interviews. And then as people continue to move through the process, you start to realize like, oh, wow, these 2 interviewers are really aligned. These 3 interviewers are really, you know, have very different viewpoints. So you can save yourself a lot of time and heartache and friction, not just in the search, but internally in your company. If you care for that, you know, making sure everybody's expectations and desires are aligned. So that's one really important thing. Now, there are other tools you can use, right? I mean, you can use a recruiter like me for, you know, an additional kind of verification. You can use things like the Predictive Index or Plum and, you know, different kind of personality indexing tools and things like that. And, you know, it's also important, though, when you have candidates take those, that you share with them kind of what it really is, right? This is about helping us understand how to best work with you and not to kind of disqualify you because the personality test isn't going to work out or something like that. So I think you have to be sensitive on both sides, right? Because you don't want to disenfranchise a great candidate too much to the point where it turns them off. But I think those tools can be helpful if they're used judiciously.
Yeah.
So that would be another consideration.
Yeah, got it. Okay. Mm-hmm. And in terms of sort of preparation, right, like the things that a company should have in place before embarking on kind of an interview or a search process, what else do you recommend, you know, beyond sort of the alignment of the interview panel? What are other things that, you know, companies should be thinking about?
Yeah. So here's something interesting, and I'm not sure how hiring managers are going to feel about this, but if you are working with a recruiter, even if it's an internal recruiter, if they've proven themselves to be effective and you know, trustworthy to some extent, I think that it is important to empower whoever's doing the recruiting with some of the information that that candidates are going to ask for. And a lot of that information is stuff that people don't like to share. It's margins, it's revenue, it's, you know, growth, year-over-year growth, things like this, an exit plan. Not all recruiters are going to be equipped to talk candidates through all those things. But if you do have a recruiter that is capable of that, I think that having all those numbers available upfront is also very powerful in terms of keeping the search moving quickly, being able to attract, you know, high value candidates. Because think about it like this. If you're going fishing and you want to get a big fish and you put nothing on the hook and you just cast your line, you're probably not going to get any big fish, right? So you have to give them something to put on the hook. And that might be the revenue numbers. It might be, you know, recent funding information if it's public. So anyways, that would be another thing. And maybe you don't share it with the recruiter up front, but be ready to share it with candidates that you need to keep interested, because it is it's a two-way street, right? Certainly there are roles where you could post it and it'll take care of itself, right? You'll have great applicants and you'll find your person. And then there are other roles where that's just not going to work. And you really do have to actively recruit and sell the opportunity. And making sure you have the right tools to sell the opportunity is super important.
Yeah. I'd love to talk a little bit more about that in terms of tools to help sell a certain opportunity. Yeah. So I'm wondering if you have any examples or any companies you've worked with who have done a very good job of attracting very high quality talent, and maybe the things that they did that are like repeatable for other people to do again.
So that's a tougher question, because for me, you know, I'm a solo operation, and so I have to be selective a little bit with the opportunities that I choose to present, the companies I choose to work with. I also have the great fortune to be able to do that. So for me, that answer might not be so helpful for everybody out there, because typically it's like you want to make sure that the opportunity is in fact a very high quality opportunity. And if it's not necessarily checking every box, being able to present it fully with the good, the bad, and ugly, I still think is the best practice, because the last thing you want to do is hire somebody who thinks the company is one thing and they get in the role and they find out that they got snowed and then they leave, right? It's not good for anybody. So, so I think being very transparent and upfront with all the information you have, the good, the bad, and the ugly, even if there's a lot of ugly, I think is still important, because listen, if there's a lot of ugly stuff hiding there, they're going to find out eventually. And you don't want that to be after they're in the role, right? Because then you probably have to pay them severance as well. And it just makes for an unhealthy environment, I think. So, you know your numbers, know your value prop, know your industry, and be able to talk people through why the space you're playing in is also worth betting on, and not just the company, not just the team, not just the investors. So when I talk about having all your ducks in a row and having all this information ready, it does include the investors, the funding, amount of funding, the frequency of the funding. Are, you know, if you can access this information, is the valuation going up? Is it going down? Which competitors are getting funded and how much? Which competitors are getting acquired, which ones are failing, right? These are all things that you need to be ready to discuss with candidates so that you can show them, you know, why it's worth them taking the risk. Because frankly, a lot of startups, most startups are very high risk, right? So you need to show them why the industry or the subsector of the industry is also worth betting on. And if you can couple that with a great team and a great set of investors with a track record, it's easy to sell an opportunity like that. If you don't have any of that stuff going on, I can't really speak to that. I can't give, you know, those kind of companies advice. I would say, good luck.
Yeah. Got it. So I know it's difficult to do, at sort of a composite, you know, or more industry level. But I'm curious to maybe take an example of a specific like executive role that you commonly recruit for. So, Pick whatever would be easiest to walk through the exercise with, but something like chief revenue, chief marketing, chief product. I'm curious sort of at what point you would say a company is ready for one of those roles. So
yeah,
could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So that's another one where there's no one size fits all for that, right? But we'll start with a really broad generic answer. It's like, when do you hire a CRO? When you're ready. And the key is knowing when you're ready, right? And so there's a lot of different perspectives that you can consider. One of them, you can do it by the numbers, right? How big is the team? How many people managers are in the sales team? You know, do you need a CRO to help, manage that team at this point? Are you missing synergies between, marketing and sales? And if so, are you missing a leader in either one of those spots or both of those spots? That's another thing to consider. I think that a lot of companies will keep some of the go-to-market functions somewhat siloed too long. Mm-hmm. Marketing and sales, really, and product just kind of has to, do their best to stay in front of them both, right? But I think making sure that you don't let one or the other get too far ahead, right? Don't wait 5 years to bring in your CMO if you already have a high-powered CRO who doesn't have a marketing background, right? So keeping parity, I think, in the different divisions of your company as you grow, I think is also something you can consider, So you want to make sure that all these executives feel like they have an equal seat at the table, if that's what's right for your business. And so that's another consideration, right? You don't want to let the team get too big. You don't want to let, sales get too much control over marketing if you intend on bringing in a marketing leader, at some point in the future, because then there's going to be a lot to untangle. Maybe some friction and some contention between the new leader and the old leader. So those are things to consider as well. It's interesting with CrowdStrike, they brought in their CMO right after the Series A. That was Joanna Flower. We placed her there. She's just phenomenal. I have another client called KnowBefore who didn't really hire a true CMO until just like a month before their IPO. And they're extremely growthy. They're, almost half a billion in revenue, and they're killing it, right? So, again, I can't prescribe a one size fits all. But I think those two examples kind of go to that statement of you hire what you need when you're ready for it. And if you don't need that CMO because, you're for whatever reason, then maybe you don't hire them until you feel like you actually do need them. But I would say make sure that there's parity in terms of who has a seat at the table in the E-team so that you avoid, contentious situations in the future. And certainly, don't hire a CMO when you have no people in marketing, or don't hire a CRO when there's, no salespeople, right? Unless it's that kind of a CRO. The backgrounds I'm talking about here are like serial, CMOs, CROs with exits under their belt and things like that. You need to make sure, again, that you're not going to waste that hire and make sure they have the resources they need to really be as effective and make the biggest impact as they can.
Yeah, got it. Okay. So let's say, an organization comes to you and says, hey, Kyle, we want a CMO and we're ready for it. And you, ask the questions that you would ask and agree they are ready for a CMO. Mm-hmm. How would you go about assessing, kind of as you begin that search, whether or not someone would be a good fit for that particular role? I know it sounds like a basic question, but
no, I mean, that's a really long and multifaceted answer, right? I'll condense it as much as I can, but there's a number of different vectors, right? So number one, they have to have the table stakes. So if you're hiring if it's a real CMO, right, it's not like a VP with a CMO title, you need to make sure they have the table stakes. How much of marketing have they really managed? Okay, they have the CMO title, but have they really owned all the different parts of marketing? The companies they did that at, were they successful? If this is a security company, do we think we need a security person? Most of the time, the answer is yes in that top role. So understanding, the companies that this person had those roles at, was that a success story or not? And sometimes, you know, certain companies look like a success story and they're not. And also the inverse is true. Sometimes companies look like, you know, they're not doing much. And then you start digging and you find out that there's a lot of history you didn't know. And in fact, that experience was a win. And so, you know, doing that diligence, I think, is really important in terms of not missing great people. So once you have the table stakes covered, you know, does this person have a good track record with good outcomes? Then it becomes more or less about the chemistry and the cultural fit, right? And so that's something where I'm not going to screen people out too heavily on the front end of a search, unless it's a repeat client that I know very well. I'm going to let them calibrate a little bit around the personality. So everybody I'm bringing is going to meet the table stakes, right? And it's going to kind of come down to these different flavors of personality. Now, that aside, what I love to do is make sure I bring my clients exactly what they asked for. And then once they have that, I'd like to also look for what I call like edge cases, right? People who maybe don't exactly fit the profile that you think you need, but maybe I found them and through my conversations with them and others, I decide, hey, this person's really worth looking at. They're a dark horse. This is a very different kind of a background, but there are some things about this person that I think might really work for this specific company. And sometimes that person ends up in the role. Actually, it's pretty frequently. One of the edge case candidates I bring in ends up in the role. And you know that can only work if you bring them exactly what they asked for first, right? So that they can be sure that they're making the right decision. So how do I assess if they're going to be a good fit? It's company by company, right? And you learn more with every search you do, which is why I love repeat business, right? Because every time I go back to tell the story about one of my clients, it gets better and richer and deeper every time.
Yeah. Have you seen any major changes in just sort of the search market over the last year or two, just as the, you know, broader tech ecosystem has?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, listen, it's a tough time for everybody in tech right now. Not in terms of executive search, but in terms of the executive talent pool right now, there's a lot of great people out there who find themselves for the first time ever without a job. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time over the last several months talking with those people as well. So that indicates to me that there's also a slowdown in terms of executive hiring. I think a lot of the companies that I talk to that are looking to hire C-levels, in a lot of cases, it's maintenance reasons. Like they have to do it. They have to replace somebody or they absolutely can't move forward without making this hire. But anything outside of that, hiring has certainly slowed down. Like everything from senior directors, VPs, all the way up through the SVPs and C-levels. So I do think we're coming towards the light at the end of the tunnel. We're not there yet, but certainly it's been a really difficult time for companies and for people. And you know, layoffs are still happening, but I do see that hiring is starting to pick up as well. So you know, fingers crossed that the next few months improve. But definitely, you know, this has impacted my business, certainly, just like it's impacted probably most of your listeners' companies as well.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned sort of meeting with candidates or, you know, potential candidates as they are considering sort of the next steps in their particular careers. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to hear just sort of your approach for advising candidates on next steps in their career. And again, I know this is, I'm asking a lot of questions that are difficult to paint with a very broad brush, but more from like a mindset or approach standpoint. How do you sort of think about those types of conversations?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to have so many of those conversations in such a short time frame, right? It's a tough time out there, but you know, I don't really give no one size fits all answer to people I talk to, but what I can say, like the advice I would give to most people, is number one, make sure your resume is impactful. And that doesn't mean, you know, throw a bunch of descriptive language in it. Usually for me, that means taking a lot of that language out and adding metrics and numbers and things like that. So I will, you know, frequently help senior executives kind of tune up their resume because typically they're too busy doing their job to keep a really robust resume, or they have one that's way too big, right? So that would be one thing that I think is important to do. And if you scrutinize your background enough, you're going to realize like, I left a bunch of great stuff out of this resume. So that sounds like a very simple thing. And listen, I'm not a professional resume writer. I don't represent candidates. I represent companies, right? But when I do think about how to assess when it's time to make the next move, and then how to assess the companies that you're considering joining, there's definitely some advice I can give there. And it's going to sound simple, but it's sometimes the simple things are the hardest things to do, right? So I think number one, understand, like, keep your finger on the pulse of the broader, like, world economy, US economy, and similarly, keep your finger on the pulse of the industry. And that means, like, let's say you have a great job, you're in a company that you love, you know, you have good investors, there's not tons and tons of dilution, and you think there's going to be an exit, and you're happy. That's great. But you should still keep your ear on the ground and be open to opportunities that come your way. Even if you're just taking those calls to learn more about what companies are coming out of stealth mode and things like that, because 3 or 4 years from now, if you're doing that all along the way, you're going to have some real informed opinions about what spaces in security are going to be hot. And you know, next up would be what companies in those spaces are you know, the ones to bet on. So I would say, even if you're heads down enjoying your role, you know, stay open to people approaching you with opportunities. Make sure that you understand kind of why the stock market went down this week. Is the Fed about to raise rates again? Like, stuff that you may or may not already consider. And then if you couple all these things together, when you start to decide, all right, maybe it's time to make a move, you're going to understand if the economic climate is one that you actually want to go into that kind of job search mode, number one. And then number two, once you start evaluating opportunities, you're going to have, as I said, informed opinions about where you might want to go. And that's everything from, as I said before, who's getting funded, who's getting acquired, you know, who's IPOing, who's losing talent. I mean, you can go on LinkedIn, pull up any company and go to insights and see a chart of their headcount, right? And that's not always 100% accurate if there's mergers, acquisitions, and things like that. But again, if you're following early stage companies, staying abreast of all those changes, trends, and then also what specific companies are doing in specific subsectors of the industry, then you're really going to have a much easier time assessing whether a company is a good fit or not, or whether or not you think it has legs. Now, let's say you did find a great company that you're super excited about and you have an offer and you think it has legs and all that, all these things align. Well, then there's some other things I think you need to consider as well, which is, is your understanding of what the best exit strategy for this company might be aligned with what the executives and the board and the investors think the best exit strategy is? Because sometimes they do have very strong, you know, clearly defined expectations for what an exit's going to be. And then other times, you know, the founding team will be very gung-ho and focused on an IPO when, you know, others on the outside or maybe on the inside feel this isn't an IPO target. This is an acquisition target. And I think being aligned with the E team on the way in there is extremely important. And you know, if you join and you're not aligned, that doesn't mean you're not going to have a phenomenal exit. You still might, but there might be more friction along the way. So I think as you pay attention to these economic trends in the broader economy, and as you pay it, you know, the IPO market, things like that, and then you also pay attention to the trends in cybersecurity, you will have an opinion eventually, if you pay attention long enough, on why or why not you think a company should IPO or should be, you know, acquired. On the way into the company, right? So this, obviously there's still going to be a lot of unknowns. But I think that I've seen in the last decade, companies raise a ton of money thinking that they're going to IPO. And then when there starts to be smoke signals that maybe IPO is not the route, they keep their foot on the gas, you know, going for the IPO. And then, you know, it ends poorly, right? We just had just less than a year ago, a very notable cybersecurity company take a down round at 10% of their last valuation, which I think is a perfect example of what I'm talking about here. So being realistic, first off, having an educated opinion about what you think the exit strategy might be, the likely exit strategy might be, and making sure that that's aligned with the company on the way in, I think is really important. And then of course, there's a bunch of other stuff to consider as well. Like, do you like the people? Do you have chemistry? You know, is it an in-person culture and you're the only person that's going to be remote? Like all these kind of more obvious things. Yeah. So I guess that I'll stop there. That's a long answer.
No, that's really helpful. Are there certain pockets of cyber that you're seeing as being maybe hotter than other parts at this point?
Yeah, for sure. So there's a couple of subsectors of the industry that I think are you know, going to have the spotlight on them for a while now. And then there's also some other non-security product considerations as well around kind of CISO roles, CPSO roles, and I'll talk about both. So in terms of what spaces in security do I think are going to be hot? Well, I'll start with the spaces and back into why I think they're noteworthy. So managed detection and response, I think, is needed in a big way right now, and I'll circle back and talk about why that is. I think application security would be right up next, you know, right behind MDR. And then there are some other spaces that I think maybe a year or two from now are going to be having more attention spent on them, like identity and access management, kind of the next generation of that, specifically for cloud and app to app and user to app and things like that. So I think that's farther out, but I do think that's something to watch for. Now, why do I think MDR and AppSec are the ones to watch right now? Well, the last decade, there's been so much focus on products and platforms, right? You can see that in the venture. If you go back and look at all the different venture rounds that happened, right? If you think about the EDR market, especially, it's a great example. It's kind of a great case study there. So now there are so many products and platforms, and cybersecurity obviously is becoming a bigger and bigger problem every day. And we can talk about, you know, the expanding attack surface and threat landscape and bad actors and things like that. But there's so many products and platforms now that a lot of companies don't know what to buy. And even if they do know what to buy, they don't know how to configure, how to integrate, and how to fully utilize the products. And so I think, you know, MDR is a space that's really needed right now in a way that it hadn't been in previous years. And there's another consideration there as well, which is, you know, all of a sudden, right? It hasn't happened out of nowhere, but recently people have been paying a lot of attention to these SEC requirements that are you know, coming around the bend, and also on the national security agenda that was unveiled earlier this year. So, you know, companies that didn't necessarily have to focus on cybersecurity, all of a sudden are going to have to really focus on that. And eventually it's going to come up on their earnings calls if they're a public company. And so I think MDR is sorely needed, and it's going to be more and more needed, especially in the SMB and mid-market companies that kind of get left behind by more expensive EDR products. You know, so I could talk more about MDR, but I think that kind of sums that piece up. Now, application security, that old saying, right? Software eats the world, and security is starting to eat software. And I think that if we just think about this national security agenda, in the past, if you're Salesforce and you ship a product with bugs that leaves your users vulnerable, that used to be your user's problem, right? Well, now it's your problem. And so making sure that there's a robust, you know, SDLC and a product security discipline in your company, I think, is also going to be very important. And there's going to be a lot of companies playing catch up on both of those fronts. And so, you know, outsourcing that to MDRs, MSSPs, there are even some application security companies out there as well, right? Like Slalom Build, and I know Synopsys as well, and a plethora of other product companies in AppSec too. So so those would be the two spaces to watch, I think. And who knows how much consolidation happens in the next years. It might change a lot of things. The other thing here along the same lines is, you know, these requirements coming out from SEC and our national security agenda, and how does that change how we think about the CISO role, right? And when I do CISO searches, it's, you know, going in, it's always interesting. I always kind of make a bet with myself whether or not the company wants to really hire a CISO or not, or if they really just want to check a box, right? And so I think companies that in the past could get away with checking a box in the CISO role are going to have to really start hiring real CISOs and paying them what they deserve, right? And not just checking a box, because eventually, as I said, this stuff is going to come up on your earnings calls, and it's not just going to be about what breaches or what you know, what breaches happened and what remediation efforts are going on. It's also going to be about what is your company doing proactively to prevent, you know, future vulnerabilities. Who on your management team has cybersecurity experience? Who on your board of directors has cybersecurity experience? Like, these are things that that SCC is pushing pretty hard on, and so I think the CISO role is going to have a little bit of you know, a time to shine here, especially when you couple that with the fact that you know, Uber's CISO had a pretty rough couple years, right? And so there's a lot more liability and risk on CISOs, or at least perceived risk. And so as companies need real CISOs more and more, they're going to get harder and harder to find and harder to hire and to retain. So anyways, I think those are the major kind of spots in security where there's a lot of change happening. MDR, application security, you know, services on both sides, the enterprise and on software development, and SDLC. And then also in terms of the CISO role and how that develops. So those are the spots to watch, I think, right now. It's definitely an interesting time for the industry.
Yeah, for sure. What are sort of the signals that a company may be more looking for a CISO to just kind of check the box rather than wanting like a very good security leader?
Yeah. Well, that's also, it's a complicated question, because sometimes a client doesn't know what a CISO is really supposed to be, and they think they want a real CISO. And then I bring them some, you know, some folks with like really impressive backgrounds, and then they see the, you know, how much they cost and also the scope that they want and things like that, and how involved they want to be and have a seat at the table. And then they realize like, I don't know if we really want that. Let's hire a VP or something like that to kind of check that box. Now, there are other companies who are like, no, we want somebody to have a seat at the table, to have board visibility. We want them, you know, interacting with engineering and making sure that we have that SDLC and product security is cared for. We want to also make sure that this person can be a thought leader in security, even if we're not a security company. So there's very different, there's like capital, I'm sorry, there's uppercase C CISO and there's lowercase C CISO. And they're both, you know, very important. I'm not taking anything away from either. But a lot of companies don't understand what they really want versus what they really need and what they can afford. So, you know, it's I'm sure all the CISOs out there listening to this right now are banging their head against their desk. But I think that it's been a long journey for the general population to start to understand what a CISO really does and what they can do and the value that they can bring to your company in a business sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And if anything, the CISOs now are asking themselves, am I a big uppercase C or lowercase?
Right. They know what they are in their heart, but they're wondering what they really are. Yeah, absolutely. Right.
A little self-awareness exercise. Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, I'd love to pivot into the rapid fire round. Wrap up every interview here. So
sounds good.
Basically, I'll ask a bunch of quick questions. You share whatever comes top of mind. Cool. So first one, what's your favorite book?
Oh man. Okay. So I have a 14-month-old daughter. So right now my favorite book is the Bee Book. It's a Berenstain Bears book. And I could recite it for you right now, but I don't think we have enough time.
All right, cool. Let's see. If you could change one thing about the security industry, what would it be?
I think it touches back on what we just talked about with the CISO role. I think the CISO role itself is an example of a broader problem with kind of the general public's understanding of cybersecurity and the risks that are posed not just to enterprises, but just to people in general, whether it's, you know, fraudsters or identity theft or data theft, whatever it is, right? I've been telling people, you know, my friends over the years, hey, don't plug your phone into the airport USB. And they think I'm crazy, and maybe I am. Mm-hmm. But I think that that's one thing I would change. I think that security is becoming more of a household topic. which is a good thing, but that would be the one thing. I think people need to understand better what this is.
Yeah. Who is someone in the industry that you really admire?
So to protect myself here, I got to say Dad, right? Because he's going to hear this.
Safe pick.
Yeah. No, there are so many. But when I think back about my career and the people that I kind of think back on, it's got to be George Kurtz. You know, I could talk all day about him and his background, but in terms of how he's affected me in my career, when I present candidates, when I talk to candidates, I still hear his voice in my head on those review calls from back then. And I use that to check myself and make sure, am I staying up to the level that we are working at with CrowdStrike, you know, and making sure that I stay hard on myself, right? So that's been really impactful for me. And then, you know, beyond myself personally, George is just, he's an industry luminary, right? And mm-hmm. he's a great race car driver too.
Cool. All right. And last one, if you could go back in time and get a drink with your 20-year-old self, what advice would you give him?
Oh man, don't buy so many guitars. You can't see. I got like 7 over there. There's another 2 over there. I have another room with a bunch of them. So I would say, let's buy a few, take it slow.
Yeah.
No, I mean, listen, on a more serious note, I think the advice I would give myself is be a little bit easier on yourself. You know, imposter syndrome is a real thing. And, you know, I sometimes also have to keep myself in check on that. So I would say, you know, if you're confident in who you are and you know, your value and stuff like that, then you can trust that. And you don't have to be so overly critical on yourself. That would be the, you know, the more serious piece of advice.
Yeah. Great. Well, I've really enjoyed this, Kyle. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today.
Yeah. Likewise. It's been a blast, Joey. I hope we get to do this again sometime.